Welcome to the newest episode of Agents of Cool. Today we look at the 2006 James Bond classic, Casino Royale. Welcome to today's episode of Agents of Cool, where we look at the 2006 James Bond film Casino Royale. It functioned at the time as a reboot of the James Bond film series, a move not without controversy, not without considerable risk. It was based on the first Ian Fleming James Bond novel, Casino Royale, which, because of Ian Fleming's profligate ways of selling off the rights to his properties, ended up out of the hands of Ian Productions for the better part of 40 years. They never had the chance to adapt Casino Royale. So 2006 comes along, movie comes out, Casino Royale. It's a reboot of the highly successful James Bond franchise, a film made as though none of the prior James Bond films had happened, quote-unquote, at all. We meet English actor Daniel Craig, not plucked from obscurity by any means, but catapulted to international stardom by the role of James Bond, as all the other Bonds usually were. And the movie was hugely successful. It was beloved by critics, beloved by fans, made money hand over fist. But we've still got some stuff to unpack here. There are actually three questions your loyal hosts of Agents of Cool need to answer today. The first question we need to ask, Casino Royale, as a movie, is it a good movie? Does it hold up? Here we are 10 years later, almost a full 10 years after the film's release, does it hold up as a movie? Our second question, how does Casino Royale relate to Ian Fleming's book? Does it deserve to carry the name Casino Royale? After all, there are a lot of Bond films that have nothing to do with the Ian Fleming novels from whom they take their titles. And the third question, Casino Royale as a movie, how does it stack up to the rest of the legacy of the James Bond film series? Is it as good? Is it better than? Is it worse? How does it fit in? Culturally speaking, this is a significant film because all the reboots you've seen in Hollywood over the last 10 years can draw a straight line pretty much to the huge success of Casino Royale. So, let's get started. Shall we introduce ourselves? I'm Eric, your grumpy-ass number six, joined as always by...
Ray, the resident Q and panel operator.
And Stacey, the local money penny.
So, well, let's get started. Casino Royale as...
The local money penny never does well in Bond movies.
The local money penny
usually always gets shot.
That's fair.
Yeah, stabbing Strawberry Fields.
Or stabbed, or set on fire, or drowned in oil.
Drowned by Fatima Blush
in what looked like some kind of, what was that, a coffee table with water in it?
I think it was some kind of pool that, like,
pool table. pool table? Like a pool table?
Yes.
And then a table that's a pool? Pool table? Right.
This is my dad joke laugh.
All right. Casino Royale. Came out in 2006. The three people doing this show right now, as well as a number of our friends back in the day, went and saw that. We went and saw it. If you recall, we had dinner at our local Johnny Carino's afterwards. I'm pretty sure I had the Bowtie Festival, because that's what I always have when I go to Carino's.
So kind of like your own personal mooseberry juice.
Kind of like that, yeah. It is very like that. So Casino Royale, we've all just watched it this morning. So thumbs up all around.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, we wouldn't be reviewing it if we didn't at least think it was worth looking at again.
I mean, well, no, sometimes we review movies that aren't or TV shows. Actually, we have a fondness for this kind of material, hence the existence of the podcast. It's unlikely we would review something for this podcast that we did not enjoy in some way. But I think in this instance, we can actually report back to you that objectively, this is a good, good movie.
Do we have any intention of ever reviewing the first film adaptation to Casino Royale?
If we can find it.
The one with Woody Allen?
No, the one with Barry Nelson.
Oh, well, maybe that one, but okay, I'm sorry.
The one with Woody Allen?
Yeah.
It might be interesting just to look at.
I saw 30 seconds of it on, like, some movie channel while I was flipping cable channels. It was a screwed up thing.
It is notoriously a screwed up thing, but it might be interesting just for historical purposes. Are we here taking the bullet for our legions of loyal listeners? Can we save them the trouble someday? We'll talk about that another occasion. So, Casino Royale 2006, directed by Martin Campbell, starring Dan Craig and Ava Green. And Judi Dench carried over from the previous series as M. Yeah, this is a crackerjack movie. It's a great movie. It's 10 years old, except for the phones they use. There's very little about this film that's dated at all, even 10 years later. Yeah, the phones are kind of funny compared. We look at the phones we've all got around this table right now, and the phones they're using in this 2006 movie are a little bit, you know, prehistoric in their odd ways. But there's nothing about the clothes, the cinematography, the cars, the fashion, none of it. I mean, this thing looks, the dialogue crackles, it's got energy and pace. Daniel Craig is hella charismatic. And, oh my God, Eva Green.
I'd go so far. I would.
What did Aldo say in Spy? Bosoms. Now, Eva Green, oh my God. She is just one of the most beautiful women in the world. I mean, she's like, who else could you get to play Vesper Lynd, really? Anyway, the movie's fantastic.
Coming up next on Eva Greencast.
Now, that's the one I do in my head. No, seriously. Now, Casino Royale is a crackerjack movie. Daniel Craig is just unbelievably charismatic. Eva Green is a wonderful actress. She's drop-dead gorgeous. Judi Dench. Now, this is the interesting question. Do we want to go deep cuts continuity first off?
I mean, this is pretty clearly a reboot.
It is a reboot. I mean, it is straight up a reboot.
We talked about this, I think, you know, earlier. You know, this is a different M than this is played by the same actress, but she's not the same character.
Because if you have Judi Dench, if you have access to her, you bring her over from the prior series. So we are, for those of you, we should do an entire podcast once debating the continuities, the ins and outs of the Bond series. So are Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Roger Moore, and Timothy Dalton all playing the same dude?
Yes.
Okay, so we got a firm yes over there. They are playing the same dude. So
I do not like the James Bond is a code name theory.
I don't actually like it, but it's worth talking about sometime.
Especially since they all have the same background. They all have the same dead wife.
They have the same dead wife. I think it's clear that at least Lazenby and Roger are the same character, because otherwise why would Roger go to Tracy's grave? But I'm not convinced that Lazenby / Roger Moore and Sean Connery are necessarily the same dude.
Hmm.
You see, I'm just playing the continuity game here. I don't actually think they're like four or five different guys with the same codename over the years. I think that Connery through Dalton at least are the same guy. I think GoldenEye qualifies as a soft reboot.
Yeah.
Although the term wasn't in vogue then, but...
Conceptually, financially... GoldenEye was, this needs to succeed very big, or there'll be no more James Bond movies ever again.
Right.
So, I mean, and in a sense, that's what Casino Royale was to the Bond franchise again. If you think about it,
11 ironic, years later. Ironic that a movie about a high-stakes card game is, in and of itself, an enormous gamble.
Well, any movie of that scale is a gamble. I mean, making movies, as somebody's commented before, is a screwball form of investment banking. I have a whole bag of money. I'm going to give it to you. You're going to hire a bunch of high-strung, neurotic talent, and they're going to parade about in front of a camera, and we're going to hopefully provide enough people to buy movie tickets and popcorn to make that money back and then more.
God, it sounds like fun, doesn't it? God, that sounds like fun.
No. It's certainly more exciting than basically saying, I would like to invest in, you know, I'd like to invest in your Sprocket Factory, Mr. Spacely. But, you know... Yeah.
Until Spacely got in trouble for insider trading, but whatever.
Well, yeah.
There was that whole scandal. George Jetson testified. I think he's in witness protection somewhere in the future right now. But Casino Royale is a crackerjack of a movie. The pacing's phenomenal. The cinematography's beautiful. Everybody in it is just at the top of their game.
I would go so far. This may actually be the strongest of the four Craig Bond movies. I mean, surely the one most people can agree on that they like. I mean, there's some people, you know, okay, Quantum of Solace, we're going to have to probably unpack that.
We got to take the bullet and do that one. There's no getting around it.
We know at least a couple of people who really hated Skyfall, even though I liked that quite a bit.
And some people like Skyfall. Some people hate Skyfall. Some people, you know, really didn't like Spectre. Some people liked it. But generally, I think Casino Royale is probably considered generally the strongest of the four. It's very well put together. It doesn't really put a foot wrong for the most part. So, I mean, we need to get the franchise back in a... We need to bring the franchise back in a new direction and give it its own new tone to basically draw in a new generation of audiences. I think it succeeded beyond all expectations, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
I can see the GoldenEye, we were talking about, you know, the continuity. I can see the GoldenEye as a soft reboot, but yeah, they bring in the new M, but she's very specifically responding to Bond as someone from an older era. So
now,
are we
thinking that Brosnan is the guy from Dr. No in 1962?
That runs into that weird problem of the guy is apparently always the same age.
Yeah. Well, people age around him because it's Desmond Llewellyn from days past, who's obviously aged considerably in the interim.
All right, okay. I mean, it's kind of like Marvel continuity. It's always, you know, a certain point, okay, Reed Richards maybe wasn't in the OSS because that would mean Reed Richards is, you know...
105 years old.
Right, so certain little details in terms of when somebody started and the things they did and the exact dates kind of get a little fuzzier the further you get from them. So, I mean, in a sense... Yeah, GoldenEye is kind of a soft reboot. You've got a new M, and Bond is kind of... I mean, Bond is very much a holdover from the Cold War. If you look at the opening with 006 and 007 taking out these, you know, the Soviet chemical weapons.
Yeah.
That's a very Cold War, we are going to go stick it to the Ruskies kind of operation. Yeah.
You know, old school Bond.
Right. I mean, it's very much, I mean, you look at the, I mean, look at the showdown between 006, 007 in the wreckage of the, big giant Soviet brutalist or whatever you call that.
Oh, yeah.
That architecture style, all those giant statues of heroes of the Soviet Union.
Where were they? Was it Leningrad? Because I was going to say it was like visit Leningrad's scenic dead monument park. Bring the kids.
Right. It's, you know.
Free soft drinks. Excellent parking. You know, all of a sudden, I want to go there now. Leningrad's dead monument park.
I
want to go there. Do they have a roller coaster? They should only have roller coasters. That'd be awesome. Ooh, the Leningrad dead monument park log flume. That'd be awesome.
I think it went back to St. Petersburg.
Was it
St.
Petersburg?
To have saints again.
Was it St. Petersburg? I don't remember the city they were in, but that's...
Well, St. Petersburg is the one that became Leningrad.
Yeah, I think it was. Actually, it may have been St. Petersburg.
Is Stalingrad still Stalingrad, or what do they call that now?
Oh, I don't know.
Poughkeepsie. They call it Poughkeepsie.
Detroit? I don't know.
I don't remember what it was called before.
Penobscot.
Huh?
Penobscot.
No.
Penobscot, Russia.
We can Google
it. I'm sorry. We'll research that. Eventually, we'll get back to talking about the actual movie, and you may never even hear this part.
Although some of this is pretty good. I hope you leave it in, because some of it's funny.
So, GoldenEye was, kind of a solid reboot. This is very much
a straight-up reboot.
Okay, boom, you see Bond.
Same director. Martin Campbell did Casino Royale and GoldenEye.
Really?
Oh, yeah, same guy.
So the guy they called to
introduce
save the franchise
is
after
Martin
the big
Campbell.
Gap is always
Martin,
this
is
guy.
Always, apparently Martin Campbell. Who's in his 70s. I don't know how many more times I can ask him to do it if they need him to do it. But Martin Campbell introduced Pierce Brosnan as GoldenEye, recontextualized the whole thing for its time. 10 years later, he comes back and introduces Dan Craig, recontextualizes the whole thing for its time. Just as GoldenEye is a post-Cold War, post-Berlin Wall, post-Glasnost Bond movie, this is a post-9/11 Bond movie. You've got to kind of recontextualize it. Who's the enemy? Who's the bad guy? What are we trying to do right now? And just as 006 had gone to work in the wreckage of the Cold War, you have Le Chiffre working for international terrorists in the post-9/11 era. So we're all thumbs up. Casino Royale is a great movie. It's action-packed.
Yes.
All right, for the sake of our form, what's your one favorite cool thing about Casino Royale?
Okay, this is the thing. Kind of like Casino Royale, the book is... There's two books. Okay,
yeah.
There's two books. There's the intrigue and such at the Casino Royale.
The card
Royale,
game.
And then there is...
The love story.
Right, afterwards. This is, in a sense, three movies.
Uh-huh.
You've got the Bond tracing the bomb maker back to the guy in Nassau to Miami and such that, you know, messes up Le Chiffre's plan to short the stock.
Right.
That's...
Entire James Bond movie.
That's pretty much an entire James Bond movie set in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
It's a Bond movie.
Well,
it's a straight-up Bond movie.
You know, Cubby Broccoli told his family, if you ever get in trouble, go back to the
go
books.
Back to Fleming.
They're
go
going...
Back to Fleming.
This is...
For the part they had to add to make it more action-y.
They go
it's actually
right
really,
back to
yeah,
Fleming.
Straight back to Fleming.
You know, it's right in Nassau. It's just like, you know, it's practically like Thunderball with 100% less James Bond riding in helicopters. He rides
that's
in a helicopter
great.
Once.
You see that, and that's... You see, Barbara's a good producer. Barbara knows what she's doing. We're doing Nassau with less Thunderball.
Right.
You can't ask for better.
So you've got that whole bit there. Okay.
Right.
And then you've got everything at Casino Royale and such, and, you know, an updating of that.
Mm.
And then you've got the aftermath of that. Mm. I mean, it's a 2.5-hour movie, and I'm not sure you really would want to cut any of that.
I can't really see a way to shorten it.
It's a really long one. I was sitting down, you know, the first watch, and I'm like, oh, yeah, this sucker's 2.5 hours long. Oh,
yeah, but it feels like it's an hour.
It goes by quick. But so in terms of one cool thing, it's very hard because there are... You've got the stuff in Nassau, and, you know, if I had to pick one either, I'd probably the bit where James Bond, you know, he gets the DB5 and he picks up...
Yeah.
Solange.
Solange. Her name was Solange.
And then drives around and right back to the hotel, and
That's good.
That was
a Bond moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. But then at Royale itself, there's so many little bits. I mean, you've got the bits with Mathis and, the various little stuff he does to the opposition. But frankly, Vesper and Bond's first meeting on the train.
Oh my God, doesn't it just crackle?
The
dialogue's amazing. They've got such chemistry.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you can, that the final ending, they say, how was your lamb? Skewered. One sympathizes. I mean, that's
one
just
sympathizes.
Like, oh,
it's so good. It's the best repartee. It's Bond. It's funny. It's character. It's just amazing.
And then you've got all of the stuff at the end, and it's really hard to pick just one bit there. I mean, I can think of things that made me go, oh dear, like, you know, seeing that $250,000 Aston Martin DBS just...
Oh, that hurt.
Oh.
That hurt.
But for that matter, even, you go back there, you know, you play the cool James Bond car music, and he's driving a Ford I don't know, is it Ford Fusion or something? I don't know. It was just the little Ford rental he had when he landed at NASA. And
that,
like,
was good.
What? This is, huh? Oh, okay. Oh, are they screwing with us? Well, actually, it turns out they are, because here we see James Bond get the DB5, probably the one that we see in Skyfall.
The one that gets scourged in Skyfall. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just kind of, I mean, this is very much an origin story. It's very much, we're going to update the bits and pieces of the James Bond origin with the little callbacks to the books and your classic James Bond films. So it's just, it's hard to pick just one. I mean,
well, let's say pick one with the caveat that there are 100 others you could.
Yeah, I mean, the dialogue on the train, their first meeting is just absolutely just...
Oh, it crackles.
Yeah, I mean, they're both just super cool, and, you know, just it's perfect. If you had to basically pick one little bit, explain what makes this movie cool, that right there just encapsulates just the whole dialogue, the whole relationship between the two. And it also just showcases, you know, those two actors. Probably, you know, it's, well, I don't say at their best, but basically just it shows just how good they are.
They're really good. Stacey, with the caveat that if you had to pick just one,
right,
what would you pick?
I did like that, the one that Ray talks about, and also the follow-up where they actually do the picking out the woman's clothes for her so she gives a certain impression and then flip it right back around to where she actually had a jacket tailored for him.
Yeah. There are dinner jackets and there are dinner jackets.
This is the latter. I need you looking like you belong at that table.
Yeah, that was good.
It's tailored.
It's tailored.
I took your measure when we first met. But what I have to talk about probably, and it's weird because it's not technically the movie, but as I think I said before, the single best combination of theme song and opening graphics that I've ever seen in a James Bond movie is this one. I love that thing. I watch that video sometimes.
Oh, the opening credits. Yes. Yeah. Oh God, that was
so cool.
It was kind of a break from all the previous ones because it wasn't silhouettes of women
on trampolines and
Bond murdering people with card symbols.
This is gonna be a problem.
Who then fall apart into card symbols?
Because I got to come up with a graphic for this to post when I post the podcast, and I already did one for Casino Royale the book, and damn, what am I gonna do for this one? Because
did you already do the card with the 007?
No, I didn't do that one. I guess I could do that one. That's just I got to come up with
or two, bullet hole seven.
I got to come, but yeah, that opening sequence is just astonishingly
and likewise good. The black and white. Oh. The opening where he earns his double.
I almost forgot about that.
That is amazing.
That was the
just that exchange that sold me on. Oh, okay, we are back. This is a different kind of James Bond movie because, and I think this is also not only is it post 9/11, it's a post-born James Bond movie.
Oh yeah,
are we really yet? When did Identity come out?
Because there's no way they're doing this really brutal martial arts fighting all the time
It was Quantum that went Born crazy.
Really?
Casino doesn't strike me as being terribly Bourne well,
just
influenced.
the sheer brutality of the fighting every time he has to smash or drown somebody always struck me as I thought the first Bourne at least came before this, and this was kind of following.
Bourne Identity was 2002.
Bourne Identity was 2002. When did Bourne? When did like Shaky Cam 2 come out?
Was that Ultimatum?
Bourne Supremacy. Identity, Supremacy, Ultimatum.
Surprisingly, Motion Sickness
Supremacy
makes it
2004.
Okay,
sickness makes it difficult for me to remember.
Had two Bourne movies before this. So yeah, this is definitely the Bourne style era. But you're right, they probably didn't necessarily do the crazy fight cam.
I think basically the fights in this one are really
brutal.
Brutal. I mean, some of the Sean Connery stuff was just was brutal for its day, but
like for example, when in Diamonds Are Forever, when he just kills a man with his bare hands in that elevator, it's evocative for me of when he's choking out that African warlord in that stairwell.
Mm. Oh yeah.
It's like, no, this is what it's like to kill a man.
Mm-hmm. And Vesper sitting there watching it and then having the reaction that she has.
That most normal sane people would...
And she curls up into a fetal position in a cold shower. Well, mm-hmm. For God knows how long.
Right. Several hours later.
There's the one little scene of, we're starting the poker game again after he gets cleaned up. And then they cut back to him going to the hotel after that. So he's been playing poker for several hours, and she's been sitting in that shower
To her credit, she obviously contacted Mathis. She did everything Bond asked her to do. And then
had her breakdown.
I didn't have the emotional space to, which, again, that's to her credit. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, in the book, Vesper is a bit...
Distant?
Yeah, well, I guess a bit more. I mean, this is Fleming writing with female characters. A bit more brittle.
Yeah.
Compared
brittle, good word.
So Vesper is obviously a competent woman in her particular
field. But she's a treasury agent.
She's not
doesn't have to deal with.
She's not an assassin.
Right.
So,
no.
I mean, she's very strict when it comes to you're spending the government's money and it's ending up in the hands of a man who funds terrorists. Can we win this card game, please? Right.
But so she's, you know, but she doesn't just completely fall to pieces where, you know, I think, you know,
but we still get that scene where we get the contrast of how she acts compared to how Bond acted, and it paints him even more as
cold-hearted,
something
brutal
wrong
bastard.
With him. Yeah. A lot of the, because in the middle you get those sort of, almost like with Godzilla, I guess, you get the kind of lovable, quippy James Bond movies, and you kind of forget, oh, this guy literally, he makes his living getting sent to murder people.
Well, he makes his living getting sent to solve a problem. Well, if somebody gets murdered while he does it, oh well. Okay.
When you send a double A to solve a problem, you have accepted that somebody getting a bad case of dead is
that's a solution.
On the table.
As the documentary about the actual MI6 that I watched recently said, there's no such thing as a license to kill because killing people is still illegal. And the people you're killing, if you're in another country, are still going to think it's illegal. So there's no point in actually issuing one. The point of the double O's having that is that they have blanket permission to end people's lives in the course of their duty.
Whatever they got
to
do.
But back to that opening.
Shooting up an embassy, apparently not the best.
Apparently not the best thing he did that day.
But that black and white sequence, remember, yeah. You know, we were talking about in the book when they're talking about, you know, how Bond got his double O, the two people he killed.
Right, yeah. Right.
And
they
mentioned
that.
One was basically, you know, a guy who didn't die easy. And and then, you know,
the other one was a cipher clerk in New York.
Oh, right. Well, somebody, right. You know, it was more of a shoot. But so, okay, boom, we got to see the movie take on that. And the guy in the bathroom in Prague didn't die well.
How did he die? Not well.
Yeah, I mean.
Well, the second one is usually, yes.
Considerably.
Yeah.
Love that.
So considerably.
Yeah, I mean,
I know what we're doing here is we're chuckling over how cool an ice cold killer is, and there's a part of me that realizes that we don't actually in our day-to-day lives value ice cold murderers in polite society, and yet, yes, considerably. we are horrendously entertained by ice cold killers in film.
That's part of the appeal of James Bond, though. That lets you laugh and be entertained by what is considered generally socially inappropriate behavior. Well, that's movies in general.
This movie in general, where you get to live out. See, and this is, I think, where Casino Royale really, really succeeds, is that it tells you this really wonderful story and provides you with the escapism that James Bond provides. You go in here and you laugh and you cry and you're thrilled and you're occasionally horrified, and it's still it's not a collection of tropes. It's a straight up good story.
I mean, the opener to this pretty much had to sell the audience on this is the new James Bond.
Right.
And so they basically...
And remember, he's been called James Blonde and put down for looking like any of the
previous
ones.
Yeah, for like a year now, he's been taking shit for this.
So, I mean, this was no holds barred. We are giving it our A game from beginning to end, and we don't let the hell up. And, I mean, the little black and white bit there, the opening credits, the whole run through the construction site.
The parkour chase is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get to catch your breath after that opener
You don't really catch your breath until you see that shot of the train. Bam, bam, bam. It's amazing.
And these are not just a little couple guys punching each other in a car park. They blew up a construction site. They're running like, you know, a Caterpillar front end loader through walls.
Yeah.
Right there, actually, that whole chase, you know, there's the reference, you know, that line basically, okay, this may be too much for a blunt instrument to understand, Bond. But you've got the guy who's chasing who's, you know, just nimbly bouncing through stuff and just, you know, technique.
Yeah.
And then Bond just drives through the wall in a front end loader or
crashes through the drywall.
Right. That's a bit. The guy goes, zips through the little ventilation duct, and okay, Bond's going to run. And then Bond just goes, smash, right through the drywall. Yeah.
Superbly written, filmed, performed, edited action
and
sequence.
That whole bit there.
It's amazing.
I mean, that's it. The whole opening hour is there to set up what kind of a cold bastard Bond is so that his decision to resign...
Has some effect.
Yeah, and that is a 180, not what the audience probably was expecting, unless they, read the book. Hey.
Right.
You know,
and we set
up middle kids.
Some of us had.
And we set up the fact of how he usually treats women. The fact that he only sleeps with married women because it's less complicated.
It's less complicated that way. Now, the black and white opening, how I've always read that, and this could just be me because there are a lot of things that are just me, their tacit admission that we know Bond did not come into being in 2006. That this black and white is to remind you of the 50s, of the literary origin of the character. We know that this comes from a different time period, but come with us anyway as we smash into the color of the opening sequence. Black and white is kind of a callback to an earlier era, letting the audience know, okay, this is from a different era. This is from a different time. We're updating it. Just come with us on the journey anyway.
If you look at the history of the little gun cam view of James Bond, you know, starts out wearing a hat. Yeah. Then Kennedy kills the hat for men. Okay, fine. Yeah. He's not wearing a hat. Okay. And then it's Pierce Brosnan in a tuxedo. And you're real classy. Okay. In this case, it's a battered and bloodied Daniel Craig in a men's restroom in Prague.
Yeah.
And this is a slightly scruffier Bond.
Yeah.
And we're going to go to some not very pretty places in this movie, yeah. which is in the book, I think, drowning the guy in the sink.
That is just what struck me as way more brutal than, I mean, Bond's killed a lot of people in the movies over the time, but shoving a guy's face into a filled sink until he dies, or technically until he gets up and tries to shoot you again. But
interestingly enough, and we'll need to, I think we'll need to do an episode on this. We'll call it, it won't be book club. It'll be four color Agents of Cool. Warren Ellis, of course, has been writing a new Bond series for Dynamite. He has been taken to task in the comics press, such as it is, about the level of violence his Bond shows in that comic. And he comes out and reminds you that in one of the books, Dr. No, Bond kills a man by dropping tons of bird shit on him.
True.
I mean, can you imagine dying like that? And these are his words. Can you imagine dying like that with your nostrils, your mouth full of bird guano? So talk to me again about the brutality later.
I mean,
the Bond in the book is a brutal son of a bitch.
Well, the Bond in the movie, I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, even, you know, happy-go-lucky Roger Moore, you know, kills a man by clipping his tie and, you know.
Bye.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
snip.
You know.
Wah!
Yeah, it's just less, the brutality and him having to deal with it is less in that situation. It's almost.
Even when Roger's killing a man, he's not like, Roger doesn't drown a man in a snake, he snips a tie.
That's fair. That's
right.
Fair.
Yeah, like he doesn't kill a man in a duck press, for example, which I wouldn't put past.
Right, whereas this one, I mean, there's not a single fight in this where Craig doesn't come out covered in blood, you know, in blood.
Covered in blood.
Some of it his, and the other guys. Some of it his, some of it the other guys, you know, more of the other guys than his, but that's because
he's very good, but he is getting beat to crap for most of this movie. Yeah. In fact, one of the things that the parkour chase shows is that, you know, they got one of the co-creators of parkour to play the bomb maker, but that Bond is basically the Terminator. His whole thing is just, he's just not going to stop, even if he has to crash through things and get stuff dropped on him and dangle from things and activate construction machinery to get from place to place.
Well, and also, you know, like, you know, the parkour guy will do, you know, the jump from the crane, makes it and then hits the stand and then off of there. And actually, I love the way they cut.
And Bond just slams into it.
Right, he went goomph and then bang and then into the air conditioning duct. And I love the way they cut that. I want to go, I didn't get a chance to watch the special features on how they did that, but I'm pretty sure when they cut away right before the impact to the sand and then go to a different camera angle. Because I'm pretty sure that structure is actually an airbag to cushion the fall when they jump from the crane on there. And then they cut to a smaller roll onto the sand covered top.
Right.
But there's a, you know, go back and watch it, because because this is all, you know, practical in-camera effects for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of little bits where I'm pretty sure it's like, okay, that was a stuntman, and then he's out of camera for a second, and then here comes Daniel Craig coming around the corner. Mm-hmm. And just the way, if there were computers used in this, it was maybe to remove safety wires at best. I haven't unpacked gone and found feature at all on that.
Sebastian Truchot actually does stuff like that. I'm assuming having him in a movie, they probably had to have him wired up or harnessed up for, because it's like, we dropped the founder of parkour off a building. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that waiver may or may not stand up in French court. But that's the art of movie making, particularly when you're making it, you know, something look utterly lethal and not actually get anybody killed. I mean, it's like you look at Mad Max Fury Road and you wonder, how did no one die in the making of that movie?
Mm-hmm. Very careful.
So that's the thing about, you know, contrasting this with, say, the, you know, going back to First Mission Impossible. These are all, we're going to do this practical effects, in-camera stuff. You know, there's minimal use of computers.
That's what mess makes it Bond.
That would have been the set piece end of the movie, any other.
That's the beautiful thing about Bond. They start where other movies end. The editor of Casino Royale is a guy named Stuart Baird, whose name has been cursed in another context by us, director of Nemesis.
Ah!
And the director of that entirely regrettable Fugitive sequel. U.S. Marshals?
Saw that. I didn't even see that one.
We saw it.
I think we saw it on TV. We didn't see it in the theater with you.
I'm pretty sure we did.
I have no conscious memory of it.
I saw it on TV. Which I think tells you everything you need to know.
Tells you everything you need to know about that movie.
Yeah. I saw it on TV much later and enjoyed it well enough because I liked the Tommy Lee Jones character.
Yeah, but then they kill off one of his kids.
Oh, God.
For no reason.
I forgot that part.
The tall, goofy one with the hair.
Are you sure we saw that?
I saw it in the theater. And
I don't think I was there for... I don't think I've ever seen that.
Well, you didn't miss anything. You didn't miss anything.
I mean, Michael Bay is a very talented cinematographer. He can put together a shot and, you know, do a bunch of interesting stuff, you know, with some fairly basic techniques and layers and zoom lenses and such. He's a talented cinematographer. I don't think you need him directing anything other than which way the cameras are pointing and how they are, whether they're in focus or out of focus.
Well, yeah.
People, for example, I think is maybe a little above his, you know,
a little above his actual skill set.
Yeah.
Stuart Baird, wonderful editor, also the editor on Superman the movie, editor on Casino Royale, and just tons of stuff in between. He's one of the best editors. He can really make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Yeah, this movie, Casino Royale, shows off his incredible skill as an editor and why he probably should, as films as a director, show why he shouldn't be allowed to ever direct. So we're all, my one cool thing was going to be that, as much as the parkour sequence was, I loved the chase on the Miami airport tarmac.
Oh, yes. Ooh.
That was going to be the one I pinged. I mean, again, because if you'll pardon the expression, you can swing a dead cat at this movie and hit something cool. Everything about this movie is great. There's no element that doesn't work. It's complete. It's perfect in itself. It's a phenomenal film.
The one thing I love most about that?
Let me guess. It's the little bit at the end where he smiles.
Right.
Boop, 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 boop. Boom.
Because the assassin is hoisted by his own petard, just like in the book.
Just like in the book.
Oh, right.
Just like, yes.
You know, bits of Bulgarians raining from the sky.
And that is an
incredible... Oh, they actually kind of called back to that. Yeah. I didn't even notice
that. You see, and that is a wonderful transition to our second question. How does this movie compare to the original Ian Fleming novel?
Well, obviously it had to be expanded.
Yep,
and like
yes.
you said, they basically stuck a whole other Bond movie on the front of it, which is really awesome.
I think if it hadn't been a reboot, of course, this is the one, I mean, if you're going to do a Bond reboot and you've got the rights to this, you do this one. You could have brought Bond in just for the, you know, the latter hour and a half. You know, basically,
but again, just because it's a Bond movie, they expect some action set.
No, that's fair. And there were some...
This could have been Brosnan 5.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could have done it where he's running down, where he's the one chasing the bomb maker, and he's the one playing Le Chiffre, and he falls in love with Vesper. You could have done that. But would have been the best way to do that? And I think the answer is probably no. Mm-hmm. As much as we should probably do... We'll do Brosnan's films. We'll cover Brosnan's films at some point.
Oh, yeah.
We'll cover those. Probably individually, but we'll probably cover Dan Craig's films one by one. The book isn't, strictly speaking, an origin story. The Bond in the book is more or less fully formed. He's wearing the clothes. He's got his habits, the clothes, the food, the drink, the cars, the cigarettes. Bond, as you see him in the book, is pretty much fully formed. Now, if you listen to our podcast on this, it's clear that he rededicates himself to his mission at the end of the book.
He has everything there except the full motivation to go after Smursh, Hammer, and Tong.
Yes.
And that, you know, comes out of the book. So, it's, you know, in a sense, it is an origin of this is what he's going to do, and this is why he probably isn't going to let anyone ever get quite that close to him ever again for a good long time.
Right.
Yeah, the book plays up the whole, which it gets mentioned in the movie, but it's not as emphasized, the whole fact that even before Vesper, he's kind of wondering, you know, does his end of the espionage business actually matter very much? The whole big picture versus what he does gets called upon more, because Le Chiffre talks about he's essentially playing like a game for boys, whereas there's this whole other level on which stuff happens, which means Le Chiffre is going to get away with everything that he does and get rewarded.
Which is the scene which they play out exactly in the film.
They do. That's true. It just doesn't seem to be emphasized as much. Whereas the book, because you can get into Bond's thoughts, there's a lot more of the going around with his resignation and all. There's a lot more of the, oh, this part that I do, there's no point to it until he gets to that, oh, they need someone who will just get rid of the Smursh guy.
In the book, of course, you've got this titanic struggle between the East and the West, between the free world and communism.
Mm-hmm.
And fast forward to 2006, you don't have that. It feels like it's whack-a-mole. I mean, this is just...
Mm-hmm. You could always frame it as order versus chaos.
Well, true, but that's, you know, that's
government, whatever government you pay, whatever government you happen to have, basically versus theocratic anarchy.
Well, that's the thing, though. In this one, I mean, it's pretty much, they don't really get into specific ideological terrorists. I mean, the warlord in the opening is pretty much, he just wants
generic African warlord.
Right, and basically permanently interested in getting a reasonable rate of return on his money and being the top skull in the pile of skulls.
Yeah.
Similarly, Le Chiffre doesn't have any particular belief other than a reasonable rate of return. And Mr. White obviously believes in, well, they believe in good customer service, and if you're going to, you know...
We cannot be seen to be screwed over by the people that we hire.
Yeah. You know, so kind of like Spectre refunded part of the ransom when back in the books when the hostage was not returned intact as promised because, they have their good name to keep
track
of. If you're missing 25% of your hostage, you get back 25% of your ransom. That's fair.
Yeah, that's, you know, we...
That's fair.
So, and that's as you don't quite have...
Now, wouldn't you love to be like the phone customer service guy for Spectre? You see, we need to call Susan and let her write that later because she could make that
sing. I don't know. Okay, call center work is pretty bad. You know, call center work is not great on a good day, and that's when you have an organization that's constrained by laws.
I'm just picturing in my head, like, the little cubicle farm, all these guys working in Spectre customer service. You're getting calls from, like, if they outsource something to, you know, like, the Chinese. The Chinese are calling in complaining about something.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Parrot, but I'm afraid you've not been processing enough calls this week. Bzz, bzz, and the entire cube just goes into the incinerator in the basement.
I'm still alive down here. I'm really quite badly burned.
Okay, so you don't quite have this giant Titanic struggle, so they make it a lot more about the toll this takes on Bond himself. Yeah. I mean, you get the, you know, you get some of the exchange with him and Vesper, and of course, you know, right at, you know, the end of the hospital, you know, he says, okay, I'm getting out while I've still got something left to get out with. Mm-hmm. So it shifts it a bit. You don't really, you can't really do Bond's internal thought processes, mm-hmm. but it shifts things from, okay, am I doing any good, yes, no, to am I going to get out of this mentally in one piece or not? And finally, he comes across something that offers something mm-hmm. better than life of, you know, killing people in Prog men's room.
And then, of course, gets it snatched away. Now, here's the thing, how it relates to the book. To all intents and purposes, this is the book.
The middle part is the book.
Okay, so the back half. Let's say the back half of the movie, to all intents and purposes,
it's actually
is the
better,
book.
Almost better than half. The whole sequence in Nassau, and that's about an hour. It's about an hour. And then you've got about roughly an hour at Casino Royale.
Right.
And then the back half hour is the aftermath.
Now they throw the whole set piece action sequence in Venice instead of just having Vesper kill herself in her hotel room.
That's true.
Although there is a moment in the film that mm-hmm. shouts out, I think, a little bit to that mm-hmm. moment, because they have connecting suites, right?
Oh, right.
And Bond opens the door. This is the morning after the stairwell battle.
Right.
And the morning after when she's like in the cold shower and whatnot. He opens the door, sees her lying on her bed asleep, and that's just like that moment from the book where he opens the door and there she is in her bed. Mm-hmm. And the guy in the book thinks, well, she could almost still be alive, couldn't mm-hmm. she? The movie pings Fleming from start to finish. It mixes it with the big set pieces audiences expect from a Bond film, but I do think Dan Craig is really playing Fleming's Bond. Although I do think the guy in the books is slightly more scalpel than blunt instrument.
Blunt instrument in the sense of, okay, there's technique to what Bond does. Yeah. You look at the chase in, like, was it Nairobi, I guess it was? There's the guy that kind of screws everything up and lets the target spot him and such, whereas, you know, Bond is just, all this bedlam is broken loose and the mark is running, you know, pell-mell, and Bond's just leaning there against the thing until as soon as the mark passes by and can't see him, that's when Bond off like a shot.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of technique to what he's done, but in the overall grand scheme of things, if they need somebody dead, they've got people to, you know, they can make somebody dead.
Yeah.
Part of is to get in there and find things out and otherwise not just stack up the body count. Yeah. So in that sense, Bond is, in a sense, a blunt instrument compared to some of the other tools an intelligence agency might have. Okay, if you have to send someone like Bond in, things have gotten
out of hand.
They're desperate and pear-shaped, and we don't have any good way to resolve this that doesn't involve a bullet.
Right. Okay, yeah, so Fleming's Bond. Good point. This is Fleming's Bond. The guy that has the terrible psychological toll, the guy that gets roughed up physically and mentally by the job. The book presents Bond more or less as fully formed, and I think this film kind of presents him as acquiring his taste for the excellent clothes and the food and the drink and whatnot. It's 2006, so we don't smoke anymore. We don't do that in the Bond films anymore, but we do have the promiscuous sex and the murder. We don't want to be a bad influence on children, so he's not smoking anymore. But we're all good with the sex and the murder. For my money, the two major differences between the book and the movie. We present Bond as becoming, as acquiring the taste that Fleming presents him as already having. And we expand the front half of the movie to give a reason for Le Chiffre's card game. And the book calls it out that he had lost his investment in a chain of brothels. And the movie is about he loses the terrorist money trying to double it and mm-hmm. playing the stock market. Interestingly enough, and I promised them I would name check this, the Newberry Library in Chicago, it's a famous research library, which has in its possession the papers of the great American screenwriter Ben Hecht. Ben Hecht, the last job of his professional life, he was hired by the guy that had the rights to Casino Royale at the time to adapt Casino Royale. And what he does is comes to the same solution that Barbara and Ian Productions do 40 years later, which is you got to invent the front half of the movie. That you got to come up with it. And basically what they do is they didn't have the entire script scanned, but basically what they show is Bond breaking down like this blackmail scheme, like all these heads of state and politicians and whatnot are visiting these brothels and they're being filmed and they're being blackmailed, and Bond tears down that whole operation, which is then why Le Chiffre has to have the card game.
Okay.
And the Ben Hecht version, it's still Baccarat, right? Now, the movie, the Ian Productions version, 2006, I think the sticking with the money and the stock market is probably better, all things considered.
It hooks it into some neat little current affairs type stuff. And, you know, in terms of a kind of like the Lex Luthor in Superman.
Lex Luthor in Superman.
Like, oh, it's a...
A real estate scam.
Yeah, okay.
He's going to destroy California for a real estate scam.
But, you know, they're obviously trying to get back to a much more grounded Bond without super lasers. And
yes. Although, let the record show that the staff and crew of Agents of Cool have no problem with space-based super laser James Bond movies. We got no problem with that. But this film irretrievably resonated with the public. They liked the retreat to something a little more grounded.
Yeah, Le Chiffre is still being irresponsible with his client's money, though, because the warlord at least is like, no risk in the portfolio. And he is immediately like, okay, we're shorting stock because I'm planning to blow up a prototype airplane.
Yeah, which is still larger than life, but not completely unrealistic.
It's like, I'm going to, even his stockbroker is like, you realize the stock is just going to go up. You're going to lose all the money. And he's like, yeah, yeah, go ahead.
So, movie versus book. They invent the front half of the movie to explain why Le Chiffre has to have the card game. And then from that point on, it's, to all intents and purposes, the book. They're playing poker instead of baccarat. High-stakes game, exotic European casino. Bond loses the money. Vesper refuses to stake him again. Gets the
minor
money.
Stakes him.
Gets the money from his brother from Langley. I'm a brother from Langley. Oh, God, I love Jeffrey Wright in this movie. Brother from Langley. I love him so much. And then Bond wins the game. And then at the moment where Vesper runs, they have a post-win meal in the casino late
night.
Yeah,
they even had the dinner.
I'm not sure if Bond's eating scrambled eggs or not.
He's eating caviar.
Caviar on some kind of toast.
Caviar on toast, which is a very Bondian thing to eat. Then Vesper looks at her phone. She's gotten a message from Mathis. Mm-hmm. Just like she gets a message from Mathis in the book, except she's getting it on her phone. Mm-hmm. And then she takes off. And then Bond has a moment where he realizes, wait a minute. Mathis comes and tells you something. Mathis doesn't text you.
Well, I think...
Just like his realization in the book that Mathis wouldn't handle it.
See, I'm wondering if he was having the realization there that Mathis might have been the one that outed the tell in the restaurant.
Mm. That's possible.
This one, Mathis is also working for the opposition, which is...
Well, is he?
Is he? Or is it...
Because in Quantum of Solace, we find out that maybe he wasn't. So that is a little bit weird because Vesper, at that point, is still wanting Bond to win so she can get her hands on the money.
Getting her hands on the money in the movie, I don't think getting her hands on the money entered into things till she lost the money and Mr. White caught up with him on the boat. I think that was a late arrangement. Spare Bond in my life and
she made a deal.
Quantum gets the $150 million and then they can presumably pay back their clients that were screwed by Le Chiffre or whatever.
And that's why.
Although, as we find out, Inspector, who's she actually working for? Is she working for Quantum? Or is Quantum just like a subdivision?
Once they had the rights to Spectre back, Quantum just got folded back
Quantum
into
was basically
it.
Retroactively declared a Spectre subsidiary.
Yeah, so, and again...
Okay, so she's not on side with Le Chiffre at that point.
That's
right. So she probably really is being brutally interrogated.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot Mathis wasn't... See, that's... God, when you watch Quantum of Solace again, I've forgotten...
I think the implication is that Mathis actually was innocent.
Okay, but in that case, he's acting... Okay.
Mm-hmm. Super sketchy.
Super sinister at the hospital. I think they want you to think.
Because that explains where the leak came from.
But then, why does Le Chiffre say your friend Mathis is my friend Mathis, or is he just screwing with Bond at that point?
But you see, that's the part that I don't get. Why would he just screw with Bond about Mathis at that point? Because he knows Bond's going to be dead in 2 hours,
right?
See, it's his intention to kill Bond.
Right. I'm wondering.
So Mathis must have been giving something to Le Chiffre then.
Right. So I'm wondering just if,
unless he's just trying to mess with Bond's
head, because he says that to a guy. Because originally I thought he was saying that to indicate who the agent was to cover Vesper. But if Vesper is not actually his agent, but White's, then Le Chiffre doesn't even know.
Vesper isn't working for Le Chiffre. So I'm wondering if that was a change, if they made that change later after.
Okay, so Vesper getting captured and possibly also tortured while Bond is actually a thing that happened. That's why there's an interrogation tape for her inspector. Because Le Chiffre doesn't know that she's not actually working for the British government anymore.
And then there's the big legendary scene at the end of the book that's also in the film where Bond gets stripped naked and has his balls beat.
Yes.
Badly. Yep. So that's there, leading to Daniel Craig's immortal line that now the whole world's going to know, you died scratching my balls, which is a great line.
A little bit more quippy and less extended. They still have a couple of exchanges between him and Vesper at the hospital where it's like neither one of them is quite sure whether he's going to function.
And then that particular plot point is resolved to Bond's satisfaction.
Yes.
The thing that amazes me, 2006, at this point, Ian Fleming's been dead for 40 years. The book is 50 years old.
Should be the most out-of-date one of all, just by time.
They make something that's not only perfectly up-to-date for 2006, but may actually be timeless. And it is Fleming. It is Fleming. They changed the game to poker because, you know, let's be honest, middle America doesn't know shit about baccarat in 2006 or now.
I think you could explain it more easily.
Yeah, but poker
was... They still have Mathis popping up to explain to Vesper, who has apparently never heard of bluffing or betting.
Well, that may be just... be Mathis trying to charm.
Well,
Mathis, that is explaining to the audience who may have not entirely followed the
I understand, but they specifically have to set up Vesper. They set her up on the train as someone who doesn't understand how poker works so that she
I think she's being sarcastic on the train.
She might not know what a tell is.
Well, okay, that's fair. And admittedly, she starts off with the, this is what you call bluffing, and then by the end of the conversation, she's doing it herself, or in reading his tells. That's right, and being all like, this poker is fun.
So, amazingly enough, the movie is Fleming. The movie is Fleming. I mean, even when it's parts that are invented for the movie, we're going to Nassau, the Bahamas, and we're quoting the way the Bond got his two kills in the first part of the movie. It's Fleming.
Mentioned a couple other things that kind of, they weren't the same scene, but they kind of got to the same place or resonated with some of the scenes in the book, if I remember. The guy getting blown up.
Yeah, there was that.
Hoisting his own petard.
You know, the car chase.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought the whole thing where Bond and Dimitrios are like trying to knife each other at the Body World without anyone in the crowd around them noticing was kind of similar to the whole deadly walking stick.
Oh,
thing.
I like that.
Even though that was much later.
Oh, I forgot about. Yeah, I had some of my notes here about that, because when I watched it the first time, I thought leaving the luggage baggage claim tag on the poker table at the body exhibit. I guess we've got our poker and gambling theme running throughout here. I'm like, why do you set it out there that obviously rather than just doing a brush pass with his contact? Mm-hmm. And on the second watching through, I realized, oh wait, he put it out there. Bond looks at that, and that buys Dimitrios the time to get around Bond, who's he's seen following him with the knife.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't set it out there because that's what he wanted to pick up. He would set that out there to draw Bond's attention away from him for a moment. And then Bond returns the favor by doing the head signal to his imaginary cohort. Dimitrios looks over his shoulder and drives the knife home.
Yeah.
So kind of the little, we're trying to kill each other in a very public place and without drawing any attention.
I love that they're just like doing different forms of like man hug while trying to stab each other. Like this needs to look perfectly normal while one of us is going to kill the other.
So are we basically thumbs up that this movie represents the Ian Fleming book and the Ian Fleming canon very, very well?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think it hits on all of the beats that the book hits on. It updates them for the 21st century, to use a shop-worn phrase, but it gives us essentially the core of what made that book really cool in a cinematic form. And frankly, that gives us a Bond we really haven't seen on screen in a while, if ever. I can think
Dalton got pretty close.
I think there's a bit with Brosnan in GoldenEye.
Where 006 says, so, all those martinis silence the screams of the men you've killed?
Well,
Do you find forgiveness in her arms for all the women you failed to save?
I was thinking more of the scene on the beach before the final assault.
Oh, that works too.
But, yes, that one too. But, yeah.
Or the fact that Brosnan talks to the service psychiatrist like Bond does in pretty much the back half of Fleming, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. Well, the bit with the... Oh, yeah, that was... Yeah, we need to get on doing the Brosnan ones as well.
After we finish Craig, let's move on to Brosnan. Let's do those.
So yeah, I think this gives us a Bond we probably haven't seen in a while, and it gives us a lot of that Bond. I mean, you get a lot more vulnerable James Bond in this one.
Yeah.
Literally stripped naked, literally.
Yeah, literally.
On screen.
I have no armor left.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That nails it right there. And
Which is why he's going to be one hard, cold son of a bitch for the rest of his life. Because he lets the armor down one time, trusts someone one time, and this is what happens.
Yeah,
she stabs him in the heart.
I don't think you see Bond getting back to that point again till really the end of Spectre.
Which tracks, you know, interestingly enough, I think they're hitting a lot of the emotional beats of Fleming and of the original film series with different names. Léa Seydoux is not a million miles away from Teresa.
That's true.
And actually, she's, again, the daughter of a criminal, because isn't she White's daughter?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Spectres, you got your Blofeld, you got your daughter of a criminal, you've got Bond actually maybe falling in love again.
Which is interesting, because it does seem like the Daniel Craig Bond will probably stand on its own as like the whole career of this continuity.
Yeah, I think if they recast, we're looking at another reboot.
I mean, you almost have to.
I mean, it would be interesting. It would be interesting if they did the tradition of keeping their the supporting staff, and then changing out the Bond, but that would
you got to keep her Sir Miles Voldemort. You got to keep him. You got
to
keep him.
He's wonderful. Really good. Though it'd be interesting to.
I like their MI6 crew. I like their Q. I like their M. I like their Moneypenny.
I'd pay good money to see Idris Elba cast as M.
Ooh,
you see, that's
they've
what
talked about casting him as Bond.
That could work too. But it would be interesting to see. You know, it was kind of refreshing.
He would be very angry. Or he could be.
Well, if you cast Idris Elba as Bond, then you have to give up the conceit that it's the same guy.
Well, okay, that's fair.
They've
already done that, though, at this point.
Well,
have they? We've decided that Casino Royale is a straight-up reboot.
Yeah. That's fair.
So you bring over Judi Dench because, hell, you've got Judi Dench.
Well, no, that's
what
I mean.
You just accept that the M from Dying of the Day is not the same character
in
Casino Royale.
No, that's what I mean. So it has been a reboot. So they have already given up the conceit that this is supposed to be the same guy the whole time.
Well,
this is just another take on
James Bond. They have not given up the conceit that Brosnan to at least Dalton is the same guy.
Oh, no. I agree. But they've already given up.
You can kind of squint, maybe Brosnan's the same guy. Like if Bond was like 20 or 21 in Dr. No, then a really hard-ass 62-year-old guy could probably do Dying of the Day. You can squint a little bit,
and Roger was
maybe.
Getting pretty old.
He was getting
by
pretty
the
long
on
the
tooth
then.
So.
You can kind of squint, and it's no more implausible than anything else. But if you cast Idris Elba, you have to do another hard reboot, or you have to give up the conceit Bond is one guy.
What I'm saying is that they've already gave up the conceit with the Daniel Craig era.
Well, no, they're not giving up the conceit that it's the same guy because this is a fresh start with a new universe.
That means this is not the same guy as all the previous ones, so they could very
easily.
But
it's just one guy with his name is actually James Bond.
Okay.
Connery through Brosnan is one man named James
But unless
Bond,
you're going to open the next one with Swan getting machine gunned by, you know, whoever
Spectre forces, which they might.
I don't know where you go with the Dan Craig Bond after Spectre.
Then basically you're doing Sean Connery's lunatic quest for revenge in Diamonds Are Forever. Mm-hmm. That's where you're going.
I mean, that's what they do in every other
spy franchise. They did that with Quantum.
See, that's the big problem here. I don't know what they're going to do next.
And
or maybe he just comes back and says, "Damn, well, it didn't work out, and we're just on."
I don't know. I
mean, it's not like he doesn't end every movie in the arms of some woman. Granted, this one seems
Think back to a second. We've got it sitting up. We've got it on Her Majesty's Secret Service,
which is
The only time he's driving off in a car.
It looks like that's over and done with, and then it does not end well.
Doesn't end well. But you see, that's the thing. If they had been smart, I think they would have saved the murder of Teresa for the opening of the next movie. Let you actually have the happy ending and then start the next movie with the machine gunning of Mrs. Bond. And I got a suspicion that's what they're going to do here. But I don't know how you do it without repeating Quantum of Solace, which nobody likes.
Right. And question is, okay, do they think money? Does Craig still want to keep doing this? I mean...
Which is a big question mark right now.
You know, these are...
At least after doing Spectre, he was like, please don't ever say the words James Bond to me again for 10 years.
There's a lot of... Now, people have compared that to saying, asking a woman in the recovery room in the hospital, "So you want to have another set of quadruplets, Mrs.?" God, no! It's a lot like that. It's a lot like Dan Craig getting done with a long, grueling James Bond shoot. "So do you want to play James Bond again? Kill me now."
That's fair.
That's fair. Now you give him a few months to rest and wait for the check to clear, and maybe being James Bond again wouldn't be that big a deal to him anymore.
That's fair. If they could go someplace, it's kind of like Batman after, after the second one, was like, okay, how do you make a sequel to that with, you know?
And there's a consensus out there. Well, not a consensus, but there's an opinion out there that maybe Chris Nolan didn't actually solve that problem very well.
I
don't share that. I think Dark Knight Rises is a fantastic operatic conclusion to a trilogy.
I
loved it.
I have my quibbles with it.
I just wish they had kept going with Robin. John Blake. I really wanted to see a Batman 4 and see him go out there. I wanted to see another one. I think that's the idea for Dark Knight Rises, and they say that this was the image they had in mind from the very beginning, which is that the legend, the mantle is passed on to someone else. Mm-hmm. That Batman, as an aspirational figure, can be carried on in the absence of Bruce Wayne.
Right. And the legend can go on without it ruining the man every time, because you can pass it on to somebody else.
Exactly. But I thought, well, let's make another one. I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I want to see his Batman movie. I'm reminded of the Batman and Robin comics done by Grant Morrison when Bruce Wayne was ostensibly dead in the DC universe, where you had Dick Grayson as Batman and Serious Angry Little Damien as Robin, and those were great books. I would have loved to have seen the John Blake Dark Knight movie.
The thing is, that again, just from a getting a movie made, it's like you want to headline it with
Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Well, at that point, Chris Nolan could have gone to Warner Brothers and said, "Well, let's do this," and they would have happily written them a check.
Right, but I think it took a fair amount. Remember, after Ledger died and such, I think it took a fair amount of finagling and trucks full of money backing up and such to get the third one.
The third one. Well, I'm not saying what you could actually get Chris Nolan to do. I'm talking about what I wanted to see.
Oh, well, that's fair. That's fair. Well, yeah, what we want to see and what we get are two very different things.
Our third question, of course, is how Casino Royale fits in with the cultural legacy of the other Bond movies, both before it and after it. So Connery very clearly is playing a man untroubled by random murder, because Sean Connery is basically a sociopath. He's like a murder machine. Kills indiscriminately whenever he feels like it, has a martini, and boinks an Italian girl. He doesn't care.
Craig is also very much in that mold. It isn't until he meets Vesper that he starts, he has anything resembling second thoughts about his chosen career path.
Or is he just copping to his second thoughts when he meets her?
That's an interesting question.
Because it's clear that the guy who's sitting in that office in that black and white sequence is still... I read him in that scene as still being fairly troubled at the man he just murdered in a Prague bathroom. The way he's got the coat, you see just his face, he's very still, he's very contained. I see that guy is still dealing.
I see it as a cat playing with its prey.
Okay, you can see it that way.
The flashbacks to what happened, I think that is supposed to be kind of Bond's reaction.
Gun barrel shot, you see him slowly leaning down to pick up his weapon, right? Mm-hmm. It took a lot out of him. I think you see a man copping to his feelings to Vesperland. Not necessarily awakening, but copping to them for the first time.
Okay, you could see that, Reed. Bond has, I think, two or three near-death experiences at the casino. Actually, if you contrast the way he copes after the fight in the stairwell, cleaning the blood off and belting down a good stiff drink.
But you look at his face when he's doing all that.
Oh, he's
shattered.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
he's shattered. And this is not the man you see in Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, or Spectre either. that Casino Royale damages the man irretrievably. Although he seems in later films, just as the character in other Bond novels and films, seems untroubled by his own damage. Seems to rather...
Oh, he seems very troubled by his damage in Skyfall.
Not the way he is in Casino Royale. Although, hold that thought. We'll get to Skyfall.
Well, it's a different kind of damage, if you think about it.
It's a different kind of damage in Skyfall. I mean, we're talking about the psychological and emotional damage of his job in Casino Royale, where he's killing and getting close to being killed and going through one near-death experience after another. And the guy you see, I mean, his armor's gone. He's the suit, the gun. He's more like the sociopath. Well, I don't think Craig's a sociopath. I honestly kind of think Connery's Bond is a little bit of a sociopath. Roger doesn't seem particularly troubled by it. Roger said that he sees his Bond as being a man who finds that he is good at killing but takes no particular pleasure in it. It's just his job. This is what he does for a living. He happens to be good at it, and there's babes and liquor on the way, so why not? Brosnan hints around at some of the psychological damage, but doesn't dig deep as Dan Craig does. Let's see, when we're talking about Casino Royale, its immediate predecessor was Die Another Day. Die Another Day was already in production when September 11th happened. Now, a year later, I remember we were all watching that in the theater, and Stacey, I do remember being ambivalent about it, but me and Ray here, we dug it. I remember an exchange while the film was going on. Ice Palace? Yeah! I mean, the invisible car, people bitch about the invisible car more than anything else. But you know, the idea that you're taking the video from over this side and projecting it on this side, when people talk about actually possibly developing some kind of cloaking technology, that's how that would work.
Well, and let's take the optical camouflage from Ghost in the Shell is the same idea.
Yeah,
so
I did not feel like the invisible car was outside the realm of fantasy that you get in a Bond film. It wasn't like Bond had a lightsaber.
And it's not like Bond movies haven't had space lasers before. Diamonds Are Forever.
Exactly. Space lasers are not terribly, specifically space lasers using diamonds again. So, well, Die Another Day was almost like a remix of the last 19-some-odd Bond films put together.
Yeah, and that maybe, I mean, it was cool, it had all the cool elements, but it maybe it didn't quite gel.
It may be that Die Another Day was just a collection of tropes, more or less.
Yeah, again, kind of like Quantum of Solace, it's got some cool, you know, it's got some cool bits in there. And you know, Pierce Brosnan is an excellent actor to watch, and there's some great dialogue.
I love him as Bond. I really genuinely love him.
But yeah, this is one where the individual piece on paper, it looked like a good idea, and we came out of the theater and like, hey, yeah, this is kind of cool, but it hasn't really quite stood the test of time that we say GoldenEye has.
Yeah, GoldenEye, which again feels timeless, even though it's specifically of its time, feels in a lot of ways timeless to me.
I'm curious how people who've just seen the Craig Bonds would
respond to it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard for us to find people to answer that question, though, because our entire circle, more or less, is composed of people who watch these things. So it's hard to find, if you will, a Bond virgin to, like, jump into this. Maybe we should do that sometime. Maybe we should look at our circles and find someone who doesn't watch or appreciate these films and see what they think about them. That would be a good show to do sometime. So Casino Royale, in the context of Bond, let me put this out there. What Casino Royale does is strip away the tropes and put the onus back on the filmmakers to tell a story again. Because I love the Brosnan Bond films. Love them all. Because GoldenEye, clearly the best one. Diminishing returns, different levels of return on the other three. I won't say diminishing. I'll say different levels of return on the other three. Tomorrow Never Dies, World Is Not Enough, and Die Another Day. I think you can honestly look at them, as much as I enjoy watching all three of them, and they're basically collections of tropes. Here's the car scene. Here's the Q scene. Here's the villain scene. Here's the henchman scene. It's all...
They don't really have the impact that GoldenEye had. And I don't think they're quite as... The stakes didn't feel quite as high as in GoldenEye,
right?
And not just for the world, but also I guess for Bond personally that one. And again, that's I think a testament to
inventing the other rogue 00 agent that was a friend of his was a great
step forward, you can really only go to that well the once.
Yeah.
But I think that gave you a,
as we complained to the Mission Impossible movies about, you get to do that the one time, not every single time.
Yeah. GoldenEye was pretty much just, I mean, it was exactly what the franchise needed. It was exactly, I mean, if we didn't have GoldenEye, we wouldn't have Bond.
But very real. Yeah.
And it absolutely just, it nailed it. I don't think, and it's hard to follow that. I mean, it's like the others were okay to, but it's how do you follow that? It's hard.
And it's like, and they tried to follow it, I think, by making bigger, more spectacular, splashier movies.
Which was, I think, the trap that got him to the point where they needed to...
That's why we go from Moonraker to For Your Eyes Only.
Right. That's the trap the previous one fell into. And they kind of, lo and behold, coming back to Casino Royale.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why you got to go. You got a big
giant
and big
space laser. Okay, let's bring it back.
Let's bring it back to something more human.
Say, murdering somebody in a casino stairwell.
Right. And still making it Bond, because we've still got exotic locales, we've still got exciting action sequences, we've still got beautiful Bond girls, we've got the gambling and the drinks and the cars and the car chases, we've still got The truth about Casino Royale is it does, in fact, have the tropes, but they're telling such a good story that it's not just a collection of tropes anymore. And as much as I enjoy the collection of tropes, and I'm hugely entertained by the collections of tropes, I love to Die Another Day. I mean, I'll watch that every day. If I'm like, it's late at night and I see that movie's halfway on, I sit down and I finish watching that movie if I'm up to 1 a.m. And the same goes for Tomorrow Never Dies, and the same goes for GoldenEye, and the same goes for all of them, really. But Casino Royale changes it from just a spectacle to giving Bond some emotional stakes again.
I always describe GoldenEye as the film that basically put everything that makes a James Bond movie into one movie because they had to succeed. And that's how they did it that way, whereas Casino Royale took a slightly different path.
The thing is, and this is where you people get caught up. Okay, you look at the fast cars, you look at the exotic locales and such, and those are kind of, we expect those in a Bond movie. But the thing that GoldenEye had, the thing that Casino Royale had, the thing that the really good one has, is you've got compelling villain, and you've got some fairly high stakes for Bond, personally, mm-hmm. if not world order, and you've got the character in genuine mm-hmm. peril and up against opposition that he's mm-hmm. equally, if not overmatched by, and still prevailing. And kind of like, you know, the analogy, you look at like the 90s comics, and mm-hmm. they read the Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, you mm-hmm. know, comics and saw all the cool fights and everything. And that's what they took away, forgetting the fact that Kirby and Lee were happy to steal from flipping Shakespeare and Brigadoon and all your mm-hmm. classics for your stories.
Or worse, the era of 90s comics where they got the superficial bits from Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen.
That's another.
Like, oh, we can have them fight each other and swear and have lots of sex now.
Right. It's kind of like.
Without looking at the intricate structure of Watchmen.
To be possibly, to possibly poke a book series, no buff, you're like, it's like you look at Wild Cards, first round, basically, okay, mm-hmm. These are, comic stories for adults, and it's like,
adult language. Meant a little bit puerile to begin
yeah.
with.
That yeah, and that's like, okay, it's like, that doesn't necessarily mean mature, it doesn't necessarily, that's.
As much as I love the Wild Cards books, and I do, he's not wrong.
Even in the new trilogy, they were like, yeah, it's like, we can now go back to actually having fun with it because adult dark superheroes is now what everyone does. So instead, we're going to do the real world Justice League.
I mean, so that's the thing. You can say, okay, boom, what makes James Bond? Mm-hmm. Okay, cool cars, preferably Aston Martins. Mm-hmm. Guilty. Cool gadgets. Okay, we didn't have any, we had a few gadgets.
We had the
defibrillator. There were even
a couple of gadgets.
The defibrillator and the tracker.
I think the tracker existed. The tracker existed to be a thing that there's no way LeChief could have known about unless there's some inside person.
Casino Royale has to.
Vesper never knew about the tracker.
We got dial back in the gadgets because the phones we have on the table can do things that would have made Roger Moore's eyes bleed in the mm-hmm. 70s.
Right. But you've got all those. But there is the character of Bond, the character of his opposition and such, and the way those interact. That's what you can have all the cool set pieces in the world and hit check off all the boxes and get one that's imminently forgettable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And again, let's also, good actors that, Craig is no worse of an actor in Quantum of Solace. It's not like he.
That's true.
I don't think he suffered concussion during the filming of.
They got stuck with a writer's strike on Quantum of Solace, mm-hmm. though. There are things outside the intentions of the filmmakers that mm-hmm. interfere with that film.
But I loved the idea of. We can't use Spectre, but in this modern, so far very grounded James Bond series, let's bring the giant acronymically named villain organization back again. That idea.
To step slightly outside, if you look at Spectre and the way it portrays Le Chiffre and Mr. White as working for Spectre instead of Quantum, you can skip Quantum of Solace like it never happened.
Yeah,
like it never happened.
Though, speaking of the whole
we can't because...
Well, we have to because,
right.
because, gentle listener, we're here to take these bullets for you sometimes.
Speaking of the whole having extra stakes for Bond, I agree that it worked very well here, worked very well in GoldenEye, and I still want to see On Her Majesty's Secret Service for that very reason. I thought that was actually one of the weaknesses of Spectre, strangely, that they insisted on doing the tied origin thing.
And that's the personal stakes doesn't have to mean right. I have been responsible for every single misery in your life, James.
But I am the author of all your pain.
You could not get a parking space on Tuesday.
I made sure your dentist ran out of Novocaine, Mr. Bond. I was the one that shorted the bagel truck that morning in December.
So, the fact that Bond thwarted this guy's schemes and basically, mm-hmm. that is sufficient. He doesn't have to basically mm-hmm. be like your twin brother's, second cousin's housekeeper's
right. Well, heck, just
catwalker.
Just the fact that this was ultimately the organization that bent Vesper would have been sufficient.
That would have been absolutely sufficient for Bond to, leave a trail of bodies from South Africa all the way up to Norway and back. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise known in his world as Tuesday.
I liked bringing in Oberhauser, but yeah, I guess we'll talk about that when we do.
Yeah,
I mean, technically we did the Spectre episode.
No, we did
a microdot.
We've been delaying a full up review of Spectre until.
I like being able to watch it at least twice. You know, once if people haven't seen it in a while, like you know, watch it once through just to get the plots, and then you know, second time through, you catch little things like, oh, hey, there's Richard Branson getting wanded at the airport.
Yeah,
you know, or you know, the bit with I didn't catch you know the bit with the luggage tag. I didn't know why did he do that. It didn't really click with me. Oh, the you know the way that worked until the second go through. So no, you know, I'll cop to watching the first watch through being. I wrapped up a little after midnight, I think.
Now, I recall when we did our microdot, we recorded that in front of the theater right after we saw it, and we were all, F, yeah! So there's the response we get right after the movie, and then I want our audience to understand that, you know, highlighting, you're our audience. Now, I want you to understand that when we dissect these things, we're still, like, we watch Spectre, and if we find problems with it later, that's still like a 9.5 movie when, like, the average Kevin Hart movie is like a 3.25. We are literally just nitpicking, and we know we're nitpicking. Spectre is a good movie.
Right.
Well, compared to Sharknado 4 or an average Ice Cube movie, and we're still dealing a whole different level.
Well, fair to Sharknado 4 knows it's a terrible movie and says we're making a terrible movie. Woohoo, watch our terrible movie.
I have never understood that.
I'm not saying
so help me God, I don't know why you do that.
I don't understand it myself, but some people like it, and again, they're being honest. It's not like
it's not like it's false advertising.
I mean, I saw a little capsule, you know, a little review of something called Nine Deaths of the Ninja, if you want to go look up, you know.
Yeah, it's not like they're lying about it. I just don't I don't understand so bad it's good.
So
bad it's bad. Some movies are so bad they're bad. And then some movies are so good, they're good.
You watched that whole Canon Films documentary, so you understand that there are kind of middling movies that are fun just because they're absurd.
But those guys were actually trying to make good movies.
Well, okay.
Whereas, they weren't trying to make something that was so bad it's good. They made movies that were just bad and that you're entertained by.
There's a story about, and I don't know if it's Anvil, about a producer that at the end of every film he went to, clapped. Because they got a movie made. Do you know how freaking hard that is? So I can totally understand that.
Yeah.
And again, I get the Sharknado guys. Okay, they're getting together. They're making a movie. They're having a bit of fun. You get, you know, get free donuts from the craft services table. You get to see some people getting, you know, everybody makes a little bit of money and everybody goes home. And we know we're not making high cinema, but we're out here to have fun.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily, it's not necessarily my particular taste in silly and over the top, but I can respect, okay, they're at least being honest. We're
just goofing around.
Yeah, we're just goofing around and, you know, whoopee. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that.
I didn't say there was nothing wrong with it. I was just saying there was nothing wrong with it. I just don't get it.
Where were we on that?
We were still finishing up. How does it fit with the other movies? Knows.
Actually, what you should do is you should actually put like a little intermission music.
Here's the point where we talk about random crap you're not interested in.
Let's all go to the lobby and get ourselves a treat.
This is the segue that never ends. Okay.
The segue that never ends. So we were discussing Casino Royale as a film relating to the films before it and the films after it. And what the hell, it's a Bond movie. It's a great Bond movie that also reconfigures the series that they now have to tell a story rather than just assemble a collection of tropes, as much as we love the collections of tropes.
It's very easy to fall into that trap, like with 90s comics and other stuff. And if you getting it right is why really good Bond movies are slightly less frequent, you know, a slightly smaller number than Bond movies. You can get it wrong. It's easy to get wrong. It's easy to get seduced by the hot, cool cars
space
and the gadgets
laser,
and,
ice palace,
you know,
Halle Berry,
the Bond
bikini.
Babes and the cool cars and the exotic locations and the cool cars.
There is a lot to be said for Halle Berry in that orange bikini.
I kind of feel sorry for Halle Berry that she didn't get her spinoff series that they were clearly trying to set up.
Yeah, Jinx was going to have her own movie. For a while, I heard, I don't know if this is true or not, they were going to do a movie with Wei Lin. I would still watch a Wei Lin.
Well, that
movie
was during that period where they were like, holy crap, Hong Kong cinema is awesome. Let's get some of those people over
here.
No,
they should have. Yes, they should have. But maybe one of the things that makes... I've also read some articles online recently suggesting that maybe Bond should be working towards another one of these shared universe kind of deals. That maybe what you don't want is Idris Elba as 007. Maybe what you want is Idris Elba as 008. And then you do and then you do a movie with 008 and a movie with 009. And then you'd have a movie where you have all these 00s together kicking all kinds of ass.
I'm not sure. I think there have been a couple of successful shared universes, and I like that. But I'm not sure that's what everybody needs to do for
I agree, frankly, I think I'm
still unclear on the G.I. Joe and every other Saturday morning cartoon except Transformers.
Bond is a shared universe, Bond is unique.
One of the things that makes Bond special is you get one of these. It's the whole purpose of Ian Productions is James Bond films. They work on it like bastards for 2 years. They give it to you. Here you go. Here's a new one. And then they take a couple weeks off, turn right around, get back to work. And it's like what makes them special and unique is that they don't come along very often. It's like they set a very, very high standard for entertaining their audience, for trying to tell good stories, for having the best stunts, the craziest sets, the good actors, all of it. They set a very, very high standard for this. And I think one of the things that make it special is that you only get one of these once every couple of years.
Yeah, if that frequently. Remember, we had a bit of a gap.
There was a gap there. Well, there were some legalities going on between 89 and 95. The whole time we were in college, there was not a new Bond film. The last one came out before I started, and GoldenEye didn't come out until after the youngest of our number, Ray, was out. So we spent like 6 years with no Bond film.
Even in the middle of the Craig series, there had been a couple of longer than normal
games. Between Quantum and Skyfall, there was some trouble with
MGM. Remember, that was the thing. I mean, kind of Skyfall, when we talked about the podcast, Skyfall was kind of the mini, we need to do better.
So, because that also had its own, I mean, like you said, this Casino Royale shows where he got the current Aston Martin DB5, but probably the pulling it out of a warehouse as an old possession of his was supposed to be a reference back to Goldfinger and Thunderball in the meta narrative.
Right.
In the meta narrative.
Well, I mean, little column A, little column B, but yeah, obviously, you know.
There was at least, speaking of whether the continuity is intact or not, there was that one video game where they decided that all of the other movies take place between Quantum of Solace and Skyfall in the Craig universe.
What?
They had the right to Craig's face?
And all those other faces.
That's the thing. They just put Daniel Craig in all of the other James Bond movies.
How did I not hear about this? 007
Legends or something.
Wow.
So at least in the weird spin-off video game of the Daniel Craig continuity, all of the movies happened between Quantum of Solace and Skyfall.
Dr. No through Die Another Day all happened between Quantum of Solace and Skyfall.
Yep, and he was in all of them.
Wow.
So they literally redid big scenes from four or five different Bond movies with Daniel Craig.
I'm actually kind of speechless. I'm a podcast host who is speechless.
Well, kind of like I assumed when they said in Star Trek Beyond that they were like 3.5 years into the 5-year mission, that was because you could fit the whole TV series.
I thought the name checked 2.5 years.
Maybe it was 2.5.
I thought it was 3. I thought it was just 3.
It was between. Okay. It was 2 and 3. Still.
No, wait. He quoted 900 days.
Yeah.
They said 900 days. What's 900 divided by 365?
About 2. It's less than 3, but.
More than 2.
Let's see. So
1,000 days is usually what they consider 3 years.
So to all intents and purposes, they completed the TV show.
Yeah.
In the space before. Yeah. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, it's roughly where the comic more or less slots in.
Yeah.
Than where
they've
been redoing the stories.
Yeah. So. The comic, which is really good. So anything left to say about Casino Royale? Are we good?
I really love it.
I could go on for another hour or two, but I think it is the strongest of the four Craig Bond movies, and I think it is one of those rare cases where you get a scene-for-scene adaptation of a book, you get everything that made that book the book adapted for cinema. Kind of like Hunt for Red October, I think, is still the best Tom Clancy movie. Mm. It encapsulates the feel of the book, even though it doesn't hit every single twist and turn and plot twist in the book.
And Casino Royale actually hits the vast majority of the twists and turns of the book and still updates it and everything else. So, yeah, pure win. It is pure win. All right. Thank you, as always, for listening to our show. We would love to hear from you. Ray, your email address, please.
Ray@agentsof.cool.
Stacy.
Mrs. Peel, all lowercase, no period, @agentsof.cool.
And me, number 6, @agentsof.cool, all lowercase, all letters. Thank you for listening. Please get in touch with us. Website, we're all on Twitter. Let us know what you think, if there's anything you'd like us to cover, if there's anything you think we missed, if you want to write us a letter. Write us an actual letter. We will read it on the air. We have enormous fun doing this show, as always. We hope you have fun listening. Please join us next time when we will be reporting back to you on the second Dan Craig Bond film, Quantum of Solace, which borrows its title from Ian Fleming, but does it borrow anything else from Ian Fleming?
I think there's a guy named James Bond in it.
There's a guy named Bond in it. Quantum of Solace, your opinion and ours, we'll see. We'll see. I don't want to spoil nothing for you, but we'll see. We'll be talking about Quantum of Solace, and then we'll probably be doing other podcasts with the Dan Craig Bond films. Book club. We need to get started on the next book club. We need to do Live and Let Die. Interestingly enough, it also folds into another soft reboot because that's Roger's first one. So Live and Let Die, we do Casino Royale, the book, and then report on the Craig Bond movies, and then we can do Live and Let Die and start talking about Roger.
Well, weirdly, I may have mentioned this in a previous episode. Weirdly, the first James Bond book I got from the library as a kid was like a 3-book omnibus, but it had Casino Royale, From Russia with Love, and Dr. No. Or other way around. No, it is that way around in the books. So I had not realized there were a bunch in between that they put later in the movies.
Yeah. And be looking out for somewhere for our Batman versus Superman therapy podcast.
our group therapy broadcast. All right. Good night. Good luck. We'll talk to you again soon. Now, our I recall when we did our microdot, we recorded that in front of the theater right after we saw it, and we were all, F, yeah! Sorry, I think I just blew out Ray's eardrums.
See, when we make the red light come on, that means the red fluid comes trickling out of my ears.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
You are wearing headphones next time, young man.